Do you guys remember where we left off? We left off with a judge named Jephthah. And all intents and purposes, Jephthah was a decent judge. He was certainly bold and valiant. He obeyed the Lord. He stood out in faith. But remember, Jephthah wasn't very schooled or skilled in the word, so it seems. And he made a foolish vow toward the end of his life. Kind of obligated God, at least in his own mind. He said, God, if you give me this victory. And then he went real self-righteous and kind of overzealous and radical. If you give me this victory, God, I promise, I vow to you, I will offer to you the very first thing that enters through the gate on my way home. And tragically, it ended up being his daughter. And I know there's the rated G version. You can read all kinds of different commentaries, and they're going to give you a soft sell on that. I kind of gave you a not so rated G version. I think he was foolish enough to go through with this vow and offered his daughter. I believe that. I don't particularly try to nip and tuck and airbrush that passage. I think it's actually something God wasn't involved in at all. God had nothing to do with any of that. That was a foolish, biblically illiterate, overzealous leader who's more into legalism, his performance, and therefore God, you're obligated to do, than grace. And I think that's the home run application myself. What about you this evening? What's your focus on? Are you like Jephthah? Are you out there looking at your performance and think, God, if I do this really good and I make these big promises and these major sacrifices to you, surely you'll give me victory in my marriage, or you'll give me victory in my parenthood, or you'll give me victory in my ministry? As soon as we take grace out of the picture, brothers and sisters, and we realize apart from him, we can do nothing, we slip into the law. We slip into legalism. Hey, if I'm speaking to you this evening, here's a very, very good book that really revolutionized the way I view grace. It's an oldie. It's a classic. It's a really in-depth title, really complicated. Ready for this? Why Grace Changes Everything. Wonderful book. And it actually teaches us that even us New Testament grace Christians, without maybe realizing it, are more legalistic than we think. And we're so focused on performance, human performance. And we become almost blind to what Jesus did for us on the cross, and therefore. Remember, Old Testament is an if-then covenant. If you obey me, then I'll bless you. I'll send the rain. I'll drive back the enemy. I'll prosper. I'll do this and that. If you disobey me and you give your heart to other gods, then I'll bring the curse. It was an if-then covenant. We live in a different covenant. That's the whole point of the New Testament, right? New Testament means New Deal. Old Testament is the Old Deal. The New Testament is not an if-then covenant. It is a since-now covenant. Since Christ died for us, now we can know God. Now we can know his righteousness. Now we can be saved. You understand the difference? Two words. If then, since now. Please embrace that. And if indeed you do, then welcome to New Testament Christianity, okay? Don't be a Jephthah. And don't think because of your radical sacrifices, now God is obligated in some way to give you victory. Victory was so accomplished 2022-ish years ago with a big loud battle cry, Aramaic word, tetelestai. Pretty awesome, right? It is finished. Payment in full, however you want to interpret it. It's a big deal. So Jephthah, okay, kind of ends on a bad note in chapter 11. And then we pick up in chapter 12. Ready? Verse 1, and the men of Ephraim gathered themselves together. They went northward and said unto Jephthah, wherefore passest thou over to fight against the children of Ammon, and did not call us to go with thee? We will burn thine house upon thee with fire. Yikes. Okay, so obviously the citizens of Ephraim, the tribal men of Ephraim, they're a little upset. They're a little offended. And if you're a Bible student, this isn't the first time, is it? This is a tendency among the Ephraimites. You guys remember the first time they did this was with Gideon, right? Gideon steps out there in faith. And by the way, they were being oppressed as a people for decades. The Ephraimites did nothing during that time whatsoever. They stood down, they turned a blind eye, and they just did the slavery thing like everybody around them. But God called Gideon, and he stood out there, him and 300 men. They risked their necks for their nation, and God gave them an amazing victory over the Midianites. Do you remember that? And when the battle was done, and when the dust had settled, and Israel was the victors, Ephraim gets offended. And they come knocking on Gideon. Who do you think you are? Taking the glory from the battle. We would have fought. Nobody gave us a memo. Nobody invited us. And see, the Ephraimites, they have no unity bone in their body. See, the Ephraimites make the classic mistake. They think the human instrument is the one doing anything. And they want human credit and human accolades. And they got an ego, you see. And instead of just seeing, God, look what you've done through us and for our people, praise the name of the Lord, the Ephraimites wanted their own credit for something that they didn't even do, though. They want credit for victory, and they stayed home hiding until the victory was over. Now, Gideon was much more tactful and much more diplomatic than we're going to read this evening. Jephthah, not so much. But Gideon says, oh, knock it off. You guys are way better than me anyway. You got the princes. Who am I compared to you? And the Ephraimites are just egotistical enough. Remember, they're like, well, that's true. We are pretty amazing. Sorry about that. You're right. And they go off with, in their own little minds, an amazing egotistical victory. And Gideon just shook his head and looked at his men like, Ephraimites, just flatter them. They'll go away. But the sad thing is, 2 decades pass, and they didn't go away. They didn't go away. In fact, that ugly ego, it seems, grew. And what is in the Ephraimite heart? It's jealousy and envy. They can't just be happy that God is blessing and using somebody else. Brothers and sisters, this is something ugly that can grab hold of any one of our hearts in this room. We can watch God use a man, use a woman, use a marriage, use a ministry, use a different church. Instead of going, praise, look what God is doing. We as a people have had a victory. And God used those instruments over there or that instrument over here. Instead of being grateful and thankful and rejoice over that, we somehow can take this big, ugly funnel and suck it and make it all about us. How do we do that? How do we make everything about us all the time? Well, the Ephraimites had it down. Because here we go again, guys. The Ephraimites, now they've watched Jephthah risk his life for all of them. And he's not looking for all kinds of credit. He's just doing his thing. Jephthah's just doing his thing. By the way, he's going through grief. He's heartbroken. That's not the smartest time to poke a guy, by the way. He's lost his daughter. And all of a sudden, these Ephraimites are poking this guy. That's not a genius move at all. When somebody's grieving, let them grieve. Just a little bit of pastoral advice, let them grieve. Don't. You might have something to talk to them about. Let them grieve. Trust me, it's just not a good time. Well, here's how it all happens. Here's the deal, Jephthah. We are going to burn you, your wife, and your child, which little did they know, right? We're going to burn your house down. We're going to burn you and yours. And Jephthah says in verse 2 unto them, I and my people were at great strife with the children of Ammon. Little history lesson. And when I called you, you delivered me not out of their hands. Oh, he actually reminds them, no, there was a time I asked for help. I got a busy signal, you punks. Our lives were on the line. We were in great strife. I called out to you for help. Remember that? Oh, yeah, we got to go back. We got to rewind the clock a ways. But I gave you an opportunity. I got nothing but a cold shoulder and a blind eye. And I wonder if they had forgotten about that. You know, time goes by. Things get fuzzy. I personally see the Ephraimites looking at the sand at this point, making holes with their shoes. Oh, man, I kind of remember that now. You had nothing to do with this, so here's what I decided to do. I didn't get bitter. I didn't attack you. Here's what I did. He says, and when I saw that you delivered me not, I put my life in my hands. I did what I knew was right, even though it was against all odds. I didn't run from my responsibility. I ran towards it, even though you weren't there for me. I put my life in my own hands, he says, and look what it says. and passed over against the children of Ammon, and the Lord delivered them into my hand. Wherefore then are you come up unto me this day to fight against me? I love this about Jephthah, and Jephthah's not a perfect guy. I think he has a lot off personally. I can't completely justify what he's about to do, although the man in me wants to, if you understand what I mean. But did you notice that Jephthah was very quick to say, no, I didn't do anything. We didn't do anything, the Gileadites. You wouldn't have done anything either if you participated. Let's make the record very straight. The Lord delivered us. The Lord gave us this victory. That certainly demonstrates that Jephthah's mind and heart were in the right place at that point concerning that, right? Let's just reflect for a second. We don't always got to be in a big rush, right? It's one of the reasons why I like devotions. You don't have to feel like you're in a big rush. Get up early and just take time and think about it. Is that us this evening, MCF? Is that us? As we see victories, as we see success, as we see accomplishment in our life, are we like Jephthah, sincerely quick to say, Lord, that's you. I know who I am. I know what would have accomplished or what would not be accomplished apart from you. I know the gifts and the skills you've given me wasn't because I worked so hard and overcame all the odds. You have blessed me, God, with a gift and a talent and a drive and a ministry, a family, whatever the case may be. Are we quick to give God credit? This culture is not, you know. This culture is very much a self-seeking, accolades culture. We love to roll in compliments. And I'm not saying we shouldn't thank people for helping us. You guys understand the difference, right? It goes a long way, by the way, when you go downstairs Sunday and pick the kids out of classroom and say to that Sunday school teacher, I so appreciate what you do. It goes a long way. Don't confuse the issue. But it's seeking for the accolades of man is what I'm describing here. I love the mindset and the heart of Jephthah. That's right on the money. But here's how he deals with this, a little different than Gideon. It says in verse 4 that Jephthah gathered together all the men of Gilead, and he fought with Ephraim. Civil war. This resulted in a civil war. Kind of significant. The men of Gilead smote Ephraim because they said, you Gileadites are fugitives of Ephraim among the Ephraimites and among the Manassites. So they didn't feel that the Gileadites were true blue, and there's some history there for sure. They're right about that. But God has chosen them. God has used them. They've certainly earned their keep at this point. And so there's a rift in this people group. And it seems that the Ephraimites are more threatening and more good with their words than they are with their hands, truthfully. It didn't seem like they had much to back up their mouths. And there's civil war. Tragic. Civil war breaks out. Let's look at the specifics. It tells us in verse 5 that the Gileadites took the passage of Jordan. That is, they blocked off the one escape route across the Jordan River where these guys could get to safety. They took that and blocked it off. They set up a military checkpoint, actually. And here's the deal. It says, and it was so when those Ephraimites, which were escaped, said, let me go over. And the men of Gilead said unto them, are you an Ephraimite? And if they said no, they said unto them, well, say now Shibboleth. And he said, Shibboleth. I don't know why. I can't help but laugh at that. For he could not frame to pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passage of Jordan. And there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000 men. So that's kind of become an English term, right? A shibboleth has become known currently in our world as like an acid test. It's a foolproof test to determine who you are, what you represent, where you're from, that type of thing. But it's interesting that we learn a lot in that, guys. As these men came to that military checkpoint, the first question is that they're asked, are you an Ephraimite refugee? You trying to run away from the battle, escape with your life is the idea. Mm-mm. And they got their luggage, you know, and they got everything. They're trying to hide their scars from the battle. No, I'm from different places over there. And I said, good, perfect, because we're not letting Ephraimites pass because we're at war with them, you understand? So real quick for me, say the word Shibboleth, and you can see the Ephraimites' eyes get really wide. I was hoping you're going to ask that. And just like down East Maine, for example, there's different dialects in different areas. And these Ephraimites could not pronounce the sh sound. And they knew that about them. They knew that they literally couldn't form the sh sound. So the best that they could do is Sibboleth. About that. Kill him. You know, and that's the way they did it. Literally, that's how they sifted through the traffic. It would be like this region. It would be like this. We set up a military checkpoint at the end of this road, and all the Mainers in New Jersey people are leaving, right? And say the Mainers just got really irritated with you New Jersey people. It's never going to happen because of the blood of Christ. You know that. But let's just pretend, hypothetically. And as you get ready to leave, we say, hey, you're not from New Jersey, are you? Mm-mm. Perfect. Say hot dog. What? Yeah, would you do me a favor? Say hot dog. Hot dog. Kill him. Right? It would be something like that. Very difficult to fake, okay? Even when you hear him say, doyad. Like, no, not quite. It's one thing to listen to Tim Sample from Mass try to fake a Maine accent. If you're from Maine, it's like not even close, but the rest of the world loves it. It's even worse when you're from New Jersey and you try to fake a Maine accent. Yeah, I hope you know I'm kidding, right? No civil war here. We love you. We're glad you're here. But it is hot dog. And it's coffee. And it's water. Yeah, amen. And it's God, not Gad. That's a tribe. I just thought. And it's aunt, not ant. There's a U in that word. You wouldn't say she's flaunting herself. You'd say she's flaunting herself, right? All right, enough. So here we go, right? This shibboleth, and that application, though, guys, all the joking aside, that was an easy way to figure out who these people were, where they were from. It's kind of interesting, though, isn't it? When you read from a Western perspective, when you read the Bible, don't you have the 12 tribes of Israel like identical people? They're tribal. They have dialects. They have very interesting things, even fashion. They all had a different banner. They were different, all different, but yet they had Israel in common. I think about that when I read like Psalm 133, how good and how pleasant it is when the brethren dwell together in unity. You know, that was the second to last of the Psalms of the Ascent, right? Did you know that? That's literally like as soon as you got to the summit, that's the song the whole nation would sing. When all the tribes merged onto the summit, just before they entered into worship, the last song of ascent is literally entering into the presence of God. But literally, as David wrote that psalm, he's watching all these different tribes from every direction gather around the temple wall and come into the gates to worship. He's looking at Judah. He's looking at Benjamin. He's looking at Ephraim. He's looking at Manasseh, Dan, Issachar, Zebulun. He's watching all these tribes converge with their different colorations, their different dance, their different unique dynamic. They weren't an identical cookie-cutter people. They were a tribal people. They all had their own unique banner, and yet they were one in their faith, in their worship of God. That's us right here. That's us. If you ever get into that trap where you think all of Christianity ought to look like you, get out of here because you're going to ruin a really good thing. All due respect. No, really, get out of here. This church is, I don't think you're here tonight. But this church is like that. They just want to make everybody look like the pastor. And it looks like everybody's like little robots. Weird, A. B, weird. Right? God has made you unique. You have a perspective. You have something that you've come through. You have something to contribute. We're not unified because we're all the same. We're not unified because we need to conform in dress and expressions of worship. We're unified because of the blood of Christ. That's what we have in common. Pretty cool, right? You never would hang out with me if it wasn't for Jesus. I know that. It's mutual too. We probably wouldn't know each other, which is kind of crazy and sad at the same time, isn't it? We never would have the relationships that we have in here shy of Jesus. I don't know that I would ever come to Down East Maine and live as awesome as the ocean is. I think I probably would have stayed where I grew up, truthfully. shooting big deer on cornfields that taste good. You get it. Well, let's go a little further, okay? 42,000 Ephraimites dead. Verse 7, and Jephthah judged Israel 6 years, then died Jephthah the Gileadite, and he was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. So that's his entire reign and involvement in Israel. Before we move on, did you guys know that the Ephraimites, you'd think, well, they really learned their lesson that time. Well, actually, it's this tribe, it's this area that leads Israel into huge rebellion. You know, when you read about the division between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, Dan is involved with the temple and the idolatry, and the Ephraimites are involved in the first major civil rebellion against the people of Israel, the tribes of Judah, the kings of Judah. It doesn't seem like the Ephraimites ever really shake this envy and jealousy thing. And they have a hard time. They have a hard time seeing the big picture. There's a lesson in that for sure. Verse 9, we're introduced to a couple of the minor judges. And then we'll begin tonight, at least, the most famous of all the judges, and that's Samson himself. But let's just finish up chapter 12. After him, Ibzan, the Bethlehem judge of Bethlehem, not the same Bethlehem David was from, actually. That's usually spelled Bethlehem of Judah, at least in these passages. He judged Israel, and he had 30 sons and 30 daughters. We probably know what that means, right? We probably know what it doesn't mean. We're probably not dealing with a monogamous relationship. If we are, oh dear Lord. 60 children. It says, whom he sent abroad. That's always puzzled me. Whom he sent abroad. How do you stop 60 kids from going abroad, right? Do you have a choice in the matter at that point? But he sends them all over to be influential is the idea. He took in 30 daughters from abroad for his sons. And he judged Israel 7 years, then died, Ibzan, and was buried in Bethlehem. So typical of a wealthy king, or in this case a judge, he's using his posterity to kind of spread his influence, to make deals, to you know, come into favor with other leaders or whatever the case may be. But because he brought in daughters from afar, from abroad, definitely tells you and I that he was in disobedience to do so. There's not much said about this guy other than that. He definitely did something that was forbidden to do for a Jewish man. And probably why we don't have a lot of highlights or victory stories. Just seems like he filled a role for a time. After him, Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel. He judged Israel 10 years, and Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried in Ajalon in the country of Zebulun. Don't know much about this guy, good, bad. Seems like he served during some quiet times for sure. After him, Abdon the son of Hillel, Parathonite judged Israel. He had 40 sons and 30 nephews, and they rode on 70 donkey colts. And he judged Israel 8 years. Again, that's a picture of wealth, influence. And Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Parathonite, died, and he was buried in Parathon, in the land of Ephraim, in the Mount of the Amalekites. There you go. Three minor judges. I'm not going to say a whole lot about them because the Bible doesn't. I'd be making it up, right? Chapter 13, verse 1. We'll go just a little bit into this. But again, this is where we're introduced to the most famous judge of all. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. It seems like that time period is growing. Do you see that? That's because the hardness of heart is growing at the same time, tragically. The Holy Spirit inspired this. You know that. If you're a Christian, if you believe the Bible is the inspired word of God, you know every time it says in our Bible, and the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, that was literally inspired, superintended by the Spirit of God himself. We get a little numb to that phrase. It becomes redundant or a little bit mundane. I'm personally convinced when the Spirit of God inspires such a statement, there is just an ache in his heart as it was happening, as it was actually being penned. This is his children. This is, as God himself described Israel. I don't know if you're familiar with that little parable in Ezekiel, but basically God says to Israel, you know, can I remind you when we met? When we met, you were basically, I think, well, there's some young ones in the room, but you basically were, I'll use the proper term, you were an abandoned baby in the womb fluids left in the middle of a field. God says, that's where I found you, Israel. Do you remember that, Israel? You literally were an abandoned baby, you know, in a pool of blood. And I cleaned you up, and I raised you, and I loved you like my own. I treated you like a princess. I put bracelets on your wrists. I put necklace. I gave you the finest garment. I gave you everything you could possibly want. And I was to you what no one would be. In fact, if I didn't show up, you would have died out there. And here you are, all beautiful and 20 years old at this point. You're decked with jewels and gold and beautiful clothing because of the good father that you have. And here you are selling yourself on the corner. What happened? God says, no doubt with a tear in his eye. That's his description. And it was meant to be a very shocking and startling parable. It was really meant to bring Israel to its senses. But more, I can't help but take that very same scenario and personalize it, because I think that's pretty much my story. I mean, we all have variables and different details in our testimony, but basically it's something like this. Hey, Aaron, do you remember when you were an abandoned little baby out in the middle of a field? Remember that? Naked and vulnerable. Wolves were on the tree line just waiting for your chest to stop going in and out. Remember that, Aaron? Yeah, that's when I showed up, and I cleaned you up, and I put a nice clothes on, and I gave you a life, and I gave you some blessing. What are you doing out here on the corner, giving yourself to other gods and goddesses? What are you doing out here? You know better. Sounds familiar, right? So I bring all that up for this reason, brothers and sisters. When God inspired and the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord, there has to be some grief when he inspired that. It gets mundane to us because we're hard-hearted and we're human. But I don't think that's the way it was with him at all. He doesn't roll his eyes. I'll write it down. Bunch of rebels again. There's a shock to this. You want to know why I believe there's a shock to this? Because Jesus came to this earth in the flesh, God in the flesh, and it literally says he marveled at their unbelief. This is God. He knows everything. But yet when the people that he has demonstrated miracle upon miracle to responded to him in unbelief, it literally says he marveled. His mouth drops open. There's only two times Jesus marvels in the whole New Testament: when he sees tremendous faith by the centurion, right? And when he sees a lack of faith from people that should know better. You want to shock God? You want to shock him? Ignore him after all he's done in your life. Act like his will doesn't matter. Act like his preferences don't matter. You want to shock him? That'll do it. Or step out there in faith and trust him and serve him and shock him in a good way. Whoa, someone gets it. Praise God, my blood was not spilled in vain. You want to make your Lord marvel? Live for him by faith. It's not complicated, brothers and sisters. I don't know why we make it so complicated. Listen to his voice and obey it. It's called faith. He will marvel. He'll marvel at that. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Right? Without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he that comes to God must first believe that he exists and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Hebrews 11:6. It's a good one. All right. Well, they did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And so God, like he promised, by the way, this is a statement of his faithfulness. He hands them over, if then covenant, hands them over to the Philistines. And it took 40 years before they cried out at this point. Verse 2. There was a certain man, Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. And his wife was barren and bare not. So his wife couldn't have kids. Kind of tragic, really tragic in that culture. The angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman and said unto her, behold, now thou art barren and bearest not. Thanks, right? Thanks for the reminder. Hey, I just want to let you know, I know things about things. You can't have kids. And she's out there. Yeah, that's right. I just want to let you know I'm tuned in all the way up there in heaven. Nothing goes unnoticed. You're barren. But look at this. But thou shalt conceive and bear a son. And you know here there's a toothy grin, right? You know the movies really destroy these types of announcements. They make these strange, like, pale-faced, gaunt-looking angels that are extremely stoic. But you will bear a son. Come on. You know everything in heaven was thrilled to say that. Hey, you barren woman, taking all the flack your whole life, being spat on by other women. Everyone thinks that you are out of favor with God. Everyone whispers behind your back that you have these secret sins. Heaven has taken note of your barrenness, and you're going to have a son. Bing! You know there was a big beaming smile. And she's like, what? What are you talking about? Pretty amazing, right? This, by the way, would vindicate this woman, and this would be an extreme blessing in this culture, and should be. Now, therefore, beware, you know, there are some strings attached. Beware, I pray thee, don't drink any wine nor strong drink or eat anything unclean, for lo, thou shalt conceive and bear a son, no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb. And he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. Extremely unique, by the way. This is an extremely unique scenario. Your son will be a Nazarite from the womb. Now, what's a Nazarite? Don't confuse Nazarite and Nazareth. I hear some people do that. That's silly. Nazareth, town in northern Israel, not to be even compared. It's a completely different word, they're not connected in any way. A Nazarite, if you're interested, is a vow that a Jewish man could make, and you're going to read about that in Numbers chapter 6. It's literally part of their law. If you wanted to take a time and separate yourself quite radically and consecrate yourself unto the Lord, there were some stipulations. There was a very specific vow. Number one, you could drink no wine whatsoever. You couldn't even eat a raisin, according to Numbers chapter 6. Nothing from the vine could enter your mouth. You were completely set apart in that way. You couldn't touch anything dead or interact with anything unclean, or your vow would be abruptly over. And you couldn't cut your hair the entire time you took this vow. In every instance outside of Samson's life, that was a temporary arrangement. It was just, I want to take a year. I want to get away from life. I want all the luxuries and pleasures and tastes of life to be on the back burner. I'm just going to completely dedicate myself to the worship and service of God for this year. And I'm going to take these things completely out of my life. I'm not going to be concerned about image and ego. I'm just going to let myself go. My beard's going to grow out. My hair's going to grow long. That's right, long hair on a man, consecrated unto God. I know you might have been raised in a church where that was evil, but it's biblical. You even have earrings and a bond slave, another biblical thing. Culture, right? Just throwing it out there. But what was unique, brothers and sisters, is Samson was called by God to be a Nazarite from the womb all the way to death. You don't see that anywhere in the scriptures, right? You don't see that in the Nazarite vow scenario. This was a very unique situation. So, Mom, I want this young man to be so set apart and so dedicated to your service, I don't even want wine to go through the umbilical cord and run through this kid. I want him to be completely set apart. Now, listen, alcohol, wine, you know, I know who I'm talking to. I know this church. I can say probably with most of us in this room, it is wrong for us to have a glass of wine with a piece of pizza, although I don't know if wine and pizza mix. I just showed you why I don't do it, right? I don't even know where it belongs in a socially appropriate setting. I've never had a glass of wine. I've had bottles of wine, never had a glass of wine. I'm not wired like that, quite frankly, and some of you are just like me. We read this and think, yeah, absolutely, if I'm going to be consecrated and set apart from God like Samson, I can't have that stuff anywhere near me. But I can't teach, and I won't teach, because I believe it's wrong, that a glass of wine is going to banish you to hell. It probably would take most of us there in this church, truthfully. But I can't teach doctrinally that a glass of wine equals sin. I can't. I can't teach that. But I can tell you that we live in a culture where so many lives are destroyed and ruined because of this stuff. And I think your witness will be profoundly impacted if you take the stuff out of your life completely. I think you will have so many more doors open to you to help people if you completely remove the stuff altogether. And we do take a position around here that if you want to serve in this church, we're asking that you have no wine in your life. Because why? Because this is a hospital. And it's a critical care unit hospital. And it's very important to us that if you serve here, it doesn't mean we think your salvation is connected to alcohol. We're not confused about that. We promise our theology is accurate. We just know that this little tinderbox we call our church family, it wouldn't take much of a spark to set some of us off. You might think that's legalistic. I think it's biblical. If we would do anything to cause somebody to stumble, set it aside for their sake. That's very biblical, and that's the ministry God's called us to here. If you want to have liberty and have wine, you are absolutely free to do that. But if you want to do that and serve here, you have to make a decision. You have to make a choice. What's more important to me? Is it my liberty and just a glass? Or is it these children or this ministry? Or being? To me, that's such an easy choice. I personally made that choice over 20 years ago. I wanted to serve Jesus, and I knew what that meant for me, and I knew the people God had called me to. Easy decision. Set the Guinness aside and pick up a Bible and stick my nose in it till I die. It's a very simple decision for me personally. But I see some people really wrestle with that decision, really, really wrestle with it. I don't mean this offensively. I really don't. We are not the only church in Washington County. We really aren't. There's other churches that don't take that position, and they have different kind of fellowships and different kind of congregations that might not be quite so raw and easily thrown off as we are. But that's not who we are. I think we have to be honest about who we are. Anyway, there's that. More about that Sunday if you come for Proverbs chapter 31. There's more about that that I think is helpful. But it's really not about alcohol. It's about the Nazarite vow. Let's finish up in verse 6. And a woman came and told her husband, saying, "A man of God came unto me, and his countenance was like the countenance of the angel of God. Very awesome. I asked him where he was from. He didn't tell me his name. He didn't tell me anything is the idea. But he said unto me, 'Behold, you are going to conceive and bear a son. Don't drink any wine or any Jameson. Neither eat any unclean thing, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" We never get this lady's name. We just know it's Samson's mom. We don't ever get her name. But man, she is absolutely thrilled. And aren't you thrilled for her? I don't know if you get into this stuff, but I do. I see her so excited saying this to her husband, and I see her husband going, "What? His face was shiny? Oh, dear Lord. Sit down. Do you need a drink of water?" You know how we are, man. We're so sensitive, and we're so tuned in to things that our wives are tuned into, and we often think they're dramatic and exaggerating. I'm just being honest. And here, Manoah, I think he had one of those eyebrows up and one of his eyebrows down. Personally, I think he's going, I need to investigate this for myself. So Manoah entreated the Lord and said, "Oh, my Lord, let the man of God which you did send come again unto us and teach us what we shall do unto the child that shall be born." You know, this ought to be the prayer of every dad, right? What an awesome dad prayer. God, you show me how to raise this kid. You show me what you intend in all of this. Please, give me a redo. Help me to hear from you. He's wanting his own personal confirmation, there's no question. Look at this. God hearkened. to the voice of Manoah. And the angel of God came again unto the woman as she sat in the field. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. I love how God does that. I love how God says, you're seeking me, you're praying, you want me to confirm this? Perfect. I'm going to show up to your wife again, and you're not going to be there. That's amazing, because what is God teaching this man? Trust your wife. She has a relationship with God. She can accurately hear. I just want to say this to my brothers in the room, because I think it's important. Leading our families, ready for this? Leading our families does not mean the thought has to originate in my mind in order to effectively lead. Do you know what I mean? No more would you expect that a good leadership direction would happen in the mind of Joe Biden, for example. But you would expect, right, advisors, people that would come alongside the president, say, this is definitely, hey, wake up. This is the definite best direction, right? You would expect advisors to advise, right? Oh, I'm glad to see you guys laughing. We're friends. Same with me, man. If my wife, who I know loves the Lord, and she's in the Word all the time, she prays, and for my wife, who God's blessed me with, to say, hey, I think God's saying this, would you consider? I would be a fool to say, I'm the man. You know how we get. It's a strange thing. Good leadership expects the people in our life to hear from God, and we take advantage of that. Would I be a good pastor if I never listened to the elders? Well, that's not my idea, so we can't do it. There's a lot we've done in this church that wasn't my idea. There's a lot of ideas that I had that we don't do because no one will listen to me. Enough of that. But it's the truth, guys. Good leadership listens well. And I really think here, God is teaching this man, I'll reconfirm, I'll say it again, but I'm going to go right back to that lady. I love that. You need to learn to listen to that woman. And it's important that we do. God's given us an amazing helper. Important to hear her heart, hear her words. Well, I know what you're thinking, but we're just going to go a little bit further. And the woman made haste and ran, and she showed her husband and said unto him, behold, the man has appeared unto me that came unto me the other day. Okay, now it's his chance. He had to believe her. Manoah arose, and he went after his wife and came to the man and said to him, are you the man that speaks unto the woman? If he ever had a chance to let us know her name, it'd be there, and he still doesn't do it. The woman. Poor girl is so generic. Maybe we couldn't pronounce it. I don't know. And he said, I am. Manoah said, let now your words come to pass. How shall we order the child, and how shall we do unto him? You know what Dad is asking? How should we raise him? What's the call on his life? Give us our orders. Again, what an awesome prayer from a parent, right? Are you going to bless me with a son? That is huge. How do you want me to raise him, though? Again, what a perfect, submissive prayer from a dad. A submissive prayer from a dad. He's your kid. How do you want me to raise your kid? May it be so of us, brothers. May we be men that raise up our children unto the Lord, give them right back to God, and say, God, if you can do anything with this kid, please do it. if there's anything good you can get out of him, show me how I can help. Show me how I can serve. A servant heart is the heart we see here. Heart of a dad. Let's pray about that, and we'll sing. Father, thank you for time in your word this evening. I pray for every dad in this room, Lord, that we would be more prayerful about the way we raise our children. It's easy to wing it. It's easy to, have our convictions. It's easy to bark out orders. It's easy to even have father-son talks that might be meaningful. But Lord, without including you, without prayerfully disciplining, prayerfully instructing, prayerfully inspiring, we possibly could be guilty of building our house in vain. And we don't want to do that, Lord. So I pray for myself and the dads in this room that we would become more prayerful as we do this role of dad. Really seek you about how and when and what. We love you, Lord. And would you be honored now as we end our time together tonight with this song? We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.